So what do you think? You ready for a couple of days off from this whole global economy thing? Yeah, me too, boy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, everybody, the 28th of August. Good as always to have you here. So, let's see. What do you think? Where, oh, where should we start as we try to sum up this week? There are almost too many choices. Almost, but not quite. Here to help us recap the somewhat amazing 5 days gone by are Neela Richardson. She is at Redfin in Washington. Sudeep Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. But he is, more to the point, live in studio with me here in L.A. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, you get to go first just because, you know, you didn't have to get on a plane and come out here. What do you make of this this week? Come on.
It was a wild and crazy week, and it ended up like a blip. If you were on vacation or binge-watching Netflix, you would have missed what just happened, which was a huge correction on Friday that started on Friday, ended on Monday, where the stock market went wild, and now on Friday, it's like nothing ever happened.
So, Sudeep, if a tree falls in the stock market forest and you don't hear it, did it happen?
If you were in the hole and it just you stayed underground 10 days, you would have missed everything. What happened is that finally, after a four-year relentless climb upward in stocks, somebody grabbed investors by the shoulder, shook them really hard to remind them that stocks can go down and not just go up, which is a really useful reminder to have because we've had this incredible environment over the last few years where central banks were in charge and they were able to suppress all of these feelings. And now it's out there and it's a more normal environment like we had before.
Central banks, though, are still in charge, right?
They're still in charge, and they're still going to be at the wheel.
All right. So, Neela, can we breathe a little bit easy about, you know, this coming weekend and the Monday open?
I think we can. What's important to remember is that what happened on Friday, Monday, the last 5 days, wasn't because Sudeep and Kai were selling their Apple and Starbucks stocks. You know, most of this market, the bulk of this trading were computers trading with other computers. It has really nothing to do with the economy or Main Street sentiment. This was a blip in the stock market that is different than what's going on in the actual economy.
Totally agree. So, Sudeep, I need you to talk to me for a minute about the actual Chinese economy. We've heard a lot this week from our guy in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, about what's going on over there. Is there some peril there?
Of course there's peril. The Chinese economy is
it's a
black box. That's the biggest problem. There's so little transparency. There's so little public understanding. The Fed here is in charge. We know the Fed is in charge, and the Fed is relatively transparent about what it's doing. You don't know when you wake up in the morning whether the Chinese central bank is going to do something wild, whether it's going to intervene in markets, whether it's going to be in charge or not going to be in charge. And until it clarifies that and until it makes people aware of what its rules of the road are, it's not going to actually be that easy for people to understand what is happening. We do know the Chinese economy is slowing, and it's slowing considerably. It hasn't been in this kind of a phase since it's been the number two economy in the world, and that's why investors are so worried about this, because they don't know what to fear on the other side.
Let me, Neela, take this a little bit sideways. There's been a commodities thing going on here for a number of months that's been, you know, interesting to watch. I want to talk about oil for a second, though. Oil is up 20% this week. Make some sense of that for me.
If I could, I would be playing the stock market right now. I think what we're seeing is a bunch of global events all coming down to one commodity, which is oil. Yeah. As long as oil stays at lows, even though we've seen a big surge up, but it's still very low from where we started last year. The idea that there would be any kind of rise in inflation is an idea that's not going to come to pass. And China plays a lot into the story. A strong dollar plays a lot into the story because China is a big demander of commodities of all kinds. If the Chinese economy starts to slow, then the demand for oil starts to slow. You pair that with a strong dollar, you get low prices, and low prices that seem to will be under $50 for a pretty long time, even though we saw a surge up this week.
Fingers crossed. All right. Now for the second weekly installment of a new game that I'm calling What is Janet Yellen Thinking? Last week, when things were going bananas, I asked Cardiff and Lee, riffing off a thing I do with CEOs sometimes. I ask them to explain what their company does in 5 words or less, right? I asked the president that. He didn't get it right. So I'm asking you guys now, 5 words or less, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Neela, you get to go first.
At a risk of using a sports analogy, yes. I think Janet Yellen's going to call an audible.
She's going to play it by ear.
She's going to look around and see it. Look at past data,
future data, real-time data.
She's going to call an audible.
Call an audible. All right. That was a long time to say three words. All right. Sudeep, you're up. That's all right.
She is going to
take her time. What is she thinking?
She's thinking, keep calm and carry on.
Oh, that was really good. Keep calm and carry on. That was really good. All right, Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. He is here in L.A. with me in the studio. Neela Richardson from Redfin. She is in Washington, D.C. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a good weekend. I am going to use a word here to describe the session on Wall Street today that we have not used in a while. 10 days easy. Boring. Stocks were positively boring, which is good. Believe you me, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big corporate news of the day is also the day's big regulatory story. Businesses, labor unions, and pretty much everybody in between is still trying to parse out what exactly a big decision by the National Labor Relations Board is going to mean for them. The board has cleared the way for subcontractors and maybe franchise workers as well to organize and negotiate not only with the companies they get their paychecks from, but also with the bigger companies that are contracting for their services in the first place. It's just the latest in a whole series of changes in what it means to be an employee in this economy and what it means to be an employer as well. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes it from there.
Believe it or not, franchising and subcontracting out labor haven't always been the norm. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
You had a situation where over the last three decades, there's been an effort by many major employers to offload large segments of their operations. And part of that was no doubt for efficiency reasons.
He says the other part was companies trying to avoid efforts by workers to unionize. Baker says that's what the NLRB ruling is trying to target.
We don't want to create a situation where we create a whole set of labor laws and then we tell companies, but if you don't want to follow those, just call people independent contractors and you're cool.
But over the past few decades, whole business models have built up around this system. And those, according to corporate lawyer Elizabeth Siggety, have now been upended.
It flies in the face of economic reality, business reality for franchised businesses.
Franchises like fast food restaurants, which are worried about what the decision means for them. And there's another trend here. Just as more businesses were using contractors, new technology made it easier for independent workers to connect with companies. Think online temp agencies, or more recently, Uber. Arun Sundararajan is an expert on the digital sharing economy. He says the way to protect employees isn't by making everyone a traditional employee.
Instead, we should sort of translate the sort of like, you know, the rights that full-time employees had to a broader spectrum of the economy.
But the NLRB decision makes clear the board's ready to change the system, saying in a statement that the current standard has failed to keep pace with the way people work. Diana Fushgart-Roth of the Manhattan Institute thinks this decision is bad for U.S. businesses.
So the NLRB decision actually fits in with some other guidelines and rules that the Labor Department has issued within the past couple of months.
She says we should expect many, many legal challenges to this decision. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The news of the migrant crisis in Europe got worse overnight. In Austria, that truck found with the bodies of mostly Syrian refugees is now believed to have held 71 people. That includes 12 women and children. Also, perhaps 150 people have drowned off the coast of Libya, en route, one imagines, to Italy. Human trafficking is, as distasteful as it is, a business. And all the smugglers and middlemen and people looking the other way take a cut of the action, driving the costs to would-be migrants way up, which means that quite often, only people of a certain means can even afford to attempt the trip, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
This is the sound of refugee celebration from people who have survived a boat ride from Turkey to the Greek island of Lesbos. Here's one of them.
We tried two times to come here. First time they let us come back to Turkey. And then the second one is succeed.
She's got a long way to go, to Macedonia and then Serbia and then Hungary. And at each point, she may have to strike a different deal with a different smuggler. Babar Balak of the UN Refugee Agency was on the Hungarian border today. He said by cell phone that smugglers often trick people by offering teaser rates and then racking up the bill.
They start little, and on the way, they make you pay more and more.
Often the price depends on who you are. In Libya, across the Mediterranean from Italy, boat smugglers charge Syrians the most, upward of $1,000. Joel Milliman is spokesman for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva.
Libyans consider Syrians the most affluent of all the migrants. They would be charging top dollar to put them on a boat to Italy. All the way down to, say, a West African from Mali or Togo might be charged 400 euros.
That's about $450. But before you get on a boat, you have to get to a port in North Africa. And for many, that means crossing the Sahara Desert. Patrick Kingsley is a migration reporter for The Guardian newspaper. He talked by cell about refugees at this stage of the trip.
And it's very common for the smugglers to put a phone to their lips while they're being tortured, and they're forced to call their families, who then have to wire money. It could be $1,000. It might be much more. It just depends on how much they think your family is worth.
Kingsley figures an African route to Europe encounters five stages of smuggler payments. At each step, multiple people, drivers, militiamen, boat owners, border guards, may take a cut. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Our thanks to the BBC for their help reporting that story with us. Also, Scott talked for a long while with The Guardian's Patrick Kingsley about the business of smuggling migrants. You can hear all of that conversation at marketplace.org. We tend in this country to take our drinking water for granted. You turn on the tap and there it is, because that's the way that's been here for as long as most of us can remember. For those who came to this country in desperation, though, refugees from war or from crisis, often the only water they trust comes from a bottle. The Hmong people from Laos are like that. And the Hmong community in Minneapolis, where many of them settled, are some of the poorest residents of that city. So officials there are trying to change their perceptions and save them some money at the same time. Curtis Gilbert has that story.
Good Deal Oriental Grocery Store in North Minneapolis sold nearly 9,000 gallons of water last month. The store takes city water, filters it, and charges customers 30 cents a gallon to fill up. Shua Vu has been buying water this way for decades. She assumed the stuff coming out of her tap was tainted. Vu is originally from Laos. Her people, the Hmong, fought alongside the U.S. during the Vietnam War. After the war ended, they faced persecution and fled to refugee camps. Many eventually immigrated here, to Minnesota. Blong Yang was only 3 when he came to the U.S. He inherited his parents' beliefs about tap water.
To be honest with you, I mean, I only drank from the tap maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. It's ingrained with you. I mean, it's cultural for you.
Yang says many Hmong families spend $25 a month on water. Sometimes more. It's a lot of money, considering their incomes lag the general population's by $25,000 a year on average. In 2013, Yang became the first Hmong American on the Minneapolis City Council. Now he's using that position to teach his community to trust the tap.
Good morning. I just wanted to welcome you guys to the water treatment plant. I mean, this is...
Yang recruited about 20 residents to tour the facility, including a group of elderly Hmong women from a local senior center. Water Treatment Superintendent Annika Bankston shows them the laboratory where scientists track water quality using sophisticated equipment.
We have a gas chromatograph, mass spectrophotometer. That's what we use.
Some of the monitoring systems have simpler names. Call them clams, actual clams, or technically freshwater mussels. The little creatures sample the water from the Mississippi River before it's pulled into the plant and treated.
And so if there's ever a rapid change, or if all of a sudden all the clams close their mouths, we know that something's gone very different with the river, and it alerts us to do some extra testing, be vigilant in how we treat the process, maybe shut down the intakes temporarily until we know what's going on.
The elders are clearly impressed. Yang translates.
They're marveling at the scientific minds that put all this stuff together.
The tour ends with a blind taste test. The water in one cup comes from a bottle, the other from the tap. People vote on which one tastes better.
10 people selected water number one, and this is store-bought water Destiny. Woo!
Expensive water.
Expensive water. Then tap water has 10. 10 as well.
The taste test is a toss-up, but the price difference is huge. Minneapolis charges just a fraction of a penny for a gallon of tap water. One of the women yells out to Councilmember Yang. Yang translates again.
Why didn't we know earlier so we would not waste our money?
Councilmember Yang says he's glad they know now. In Minneapolis, I'm Curtis Gilbert for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's a picture of George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Phil Crane, and Howard Baker at a restaurant in Portsmouth called Yokin's.
Call it a quadfecta for a campaign photographer, but first, let's do the numbers. It's like it almost didn't happen, right? The Dow Industrials dipped less than a 10% today. 11 points closed at 16,643. The NASDAQ added about a 3%, 15 points, finished at 4,828. The S&P 500 gained just a fraction of a percent, one single solitary point, ended things at 1,988 for the week. And remember here, please, people, that it's all relative. The Dow ticked up 1.1%. The NASDAQ advanced 2.6%. The S&P 500 up 0.9%. Financial stocks slipped after a Fed official suggested at that party they're having out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that a September interest rate hike is still likely. Me? I don't know. Bank of America gave back 0.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase lost about the same. Morgan Stanley threw off 0.7% today. Tech stocks mostly up. Facebook climbed nearly 1.5%. Twitter flew up 1.4%. Bond prices rose a teeny little bit. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell a teeny little bit, 2.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Tennis players hit the courts in Flushing Meadows, Queens for the U.S. Open. The Senate Small Business Committee holds a field hearing in Manchester, New Hampshire, on opportunities and challenges small businesses face in hiring a skilled workforce. And 18 years ago, Princess Diana died in a car crash in Paris. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so which are you? Are you a portrait person or a landscape person? With your phone, I mean, and the camera. I ask because Instagram, which was formerly smack in the middle with a square pictures-only thank-you-very-much format, now says it's going to let its 300 million-plus users shoot sideways or straight up and down. Keeping the customers happy is, of course, good business, but that is only part of it. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains the bigger strategy behind thinking outside of the box.
It's pretty simple.
It's no longer hip to be square.
Not if you want to sell a lot of ads. Nate Carter is managing director with Effective, a company that buys and places digital ads. He says, until now, if you wanted to advertise on Instagram, you were kind of boxed in.
You needed to receive prior approval from Instagram and have rather lofty budgets in order to be appearing on their platform.
But he says, in the fall, Instagram is planning to open its app to all advertisers, and that's one reason the company is changing its format. It wants to be more flexible so advertisers can repurpose the ads they use on TV. Right now, one of every five pictures and videos users post is not square. Wally Krantz is with Landor, a branding firm.
People have been trying to game the system already.
While there's a whole series of apps users have turned to get around Instagram's square format, Krantz says square photos are a classic.
Traditionally, if you go way back, a lot of them were. If you think of like Rolleiflex cameras and Hasselblads.
And legend has it that it was a camera that turned Instagram square in the first place. Kevin Systrom, the company's founder, used a Holga camera in college. It took square photos. Brett Hansen is with Siegel & Gale, the global branding firm. He says now Instagram is known for being square, and fiddling with that look could be risky.
By changing it up, they're kind of like diluting their brand image a little bit.
You're square. You want to stay square.
I'm square. I'm totally square.
But Nate Carter with Effective says if Instagram manages to bring in more advertisers by dropping its box, it stands to make billions. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We're still 5 or so months from the New Hampshire primaries, which might seem like a long time to most of us. But for Associated Press photographer Jim Cole, it is going to be a long slog. He's been covering politicians going to New Hampshire to campaign since 1980, and he is back at it this time around. He is also the latest in our Every Now and Then series about jobs that revolve around political campaigns. Mr. Cole, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Do you remember the first campaign picture you ever took?
Oh, my first campaign picture? No.
All
the
right.
Absolute first one I'm not going to be able to come up with.
What about the first one you remember?
The one that I remember, I went back through some stuff recently just to check out what I got. It was the campaign. It's a picture of George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Phil Crane, and Howard Baker.
Wow.
At a restaurant in Portsmouth called Yokin's. And it was a Republican breakfast. And that's about all I can remember about that.
What is it about campaign photography that does it for you? Because, yes, New Hampshire, and yes, it happens every 4 years, but clearly there's something about it that draws you in.
I mean, it's what comes here in New Hampshire. I'm here, and it's my job to cover not only the primary but other things in the state. But I've done so many primaries now that I try and concentrate – much more instead of trying to get a picture of what these people look like, but much more what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a rule actually, right? The whole where you stand rule?
I try as hard as I can not to touch another photographer when I'm taking a picture. And when I go to an event, I see the event as best I can and try and foresee what possibly can happen and where my best chance is of getting something that's different and unusual.
Are you surprised that other campaign photographers haven't clued in and looked around and said, wait, where's Jim Cole? I'm going to go stand next to him.
Well, actually, sometimes they do.
Yeah, I bet.
And all I do is I just move to another spot.
Which, of course, drives them crazy.
I don't care.
Yeah, fair enough. Is it different for you photographing a relatively inexperienced candidate? You know, some of the GOP candidates this time, and in fact, some of the Democrats as well, are first-timers on the national stage. Is it different photographing them versus somebody who's been through the ringer a couple of times?
Yeah. The ones that are going through it the first time, at least this time around, they're the ones that, in my opinion, are doing it right. They're doing the hands-on. They're doing the small venues, the coffee shops, and these town halls. The so-called veteran campaigns have everything all set up and staged, where the candidate comes into the room, grabs a microphone, gives their 20-minute, 30-minute speech, and then says, okay, I'll take questions, and then they go out the same door, say goodbye.
Yeah. Do you know when you've got a good picture in your camera? Do you know when you squeeze the shutter that it's happened?
Yeah. I mean, if there's something that happens and I press the button, I do feel good about what I have. I was taking pictures of Marco Rubio in Littleton. And when he was done talking, he went to speak with this woman who was in a wheelchair. And there was a really nice moment of her holding, with both of her hands, holding both of his hands, and the two looking at each other right in the eye. And it made for a nice shot. I got it, and I knew I had it.
Jim Cole, he's a photographer with the Associated Press in New Hampshire. He's been doing campaigns up there for 35, 36 years. Mr. Cole, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
final note on the way out today, appropriate perhaps given the week we've had global economy-wise. The Oxford English Dictionary is out with its quarterly update. New words added to the lexicon of record. Item number one, Grexit, to wit, end quote, a term for the potential withdrawal of Greece from the Eurozone. Item number two, Brexit, a term for the potential or hypothetical departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union. Also added, though, were awesome sauce and man spreading, so maybe we shouldn't take this thing all that seriously after all. I don't know. What exactly is awesome sauce anyway? Anybody? Anybody? All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is off less than a 0.1%, 11 points. The NASDAQ added a 3rd percent, 15 points. The S&P 500 gained a fraction of 1%, 1 point. But oh my goodness, does that not tell the story of the week? Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Sitar Nieves is the senior producer of this public radio program. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.